Hello everyone and welcome to another Glenbrook podcast. I'm lucky enough this week to have Chitra Marsh, who's an Associate Director at Buttress Architects. Hello Chitra.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. I should say that we're in lockdown, so we're both in the comfort of our own homes. And Chitra, in my mind, whenever I'm talking to an architect, I imagine you sat in a beautiful white modernist structure in a woodland glaze with floor-to-ceiling windows. Am I imagining it correct?
Oh, I'm really sorry to disappoint you. I'm in a very lovely Edwardian house, but it probably needs a little care and attention. That's the polite way of putting it. Holiday, I think, is what they call it.
Oh, well, it still sounds beautiful.
Thank you.
So we know each other well through networking group Women in Property.
Yes.
And we've known each other for 4 or 5 years now. And it goes with the turf that we're always discussing diversity in terms of gender. But today we're going to focus on cultural and ethnic diversity, particularly in the property sector.
Yes.
And I'm really keen to hear your thoughts, Chitra, on the barriers you perceive, but also, more importantly, how we overcome them. So before all that, though, for those who don't know you, tell us a little bit more about your role at Buttress. What does your day look like?
Well, so just for those people that don't know Buttress Architects, we're a leading design studio based in Manchester. I can't tell you how proud I am to work for the company. They're really people focused and there's some amazing projects, and we don't say this in a trite way, but our approach is to put people at the heart of what we do, and we wholeheartedly mean it. We've got a real company ethos about people's and buildings, and that buildings should be shaped by their surroundings, their role, and the people that use them. And we're incredibly passionate about delivering long-term positive change, making really positive contributions to communities through what we do. I'd say check out our website if you want to know more. I joined about 2.5 years ago, and I feel now that I'm a round peg in a round hole, which I'm really grateful for, and I feel incredibly lucky. I'm part of the board at Buttress, and I always feel like I've got an equal voice amongst all the other directors. And it's a real privilege for me to take an active part in the future of the company. From a background point of view, I've been practicing architect for over 25 years, but I've always leaned possibly more towards my love of people. So my career has morphed over the years towards BD, mentoring, more recently now at Buttress on our social value and mental health and wellbeing. We have a lot of coordination with the universities as well. And we try and get out into the community. We look to progress that through within the studio and outside as well.
Brilliant. It's interesting, isn't it? The different roles and opportunities there are within the property sector. And I meet so many people who work in property who came to it because someone in their family did, and they were able to convey that to their kids and to people around them to say, you know, it's not just working on a building site or, you know, checking buildings for damp. There's so many different avenues you can go down. I wasn't one of those people. I was really, really lucky and totally fell into it, and thank God I did, because I absolutely love it. But what about you? Did your parents work in property? How did you find your way into architecture?
Well, it was my dad, actually, that was my major influence in choosing architecture. He was a public health engineer at O'Varrop & Partners in the 1970s. And I think he even worked on the Lloyds building with Richard Rogers. I found it in an old diary once.
Wow.
In his old attaché case, where he's passed away. But I was sifting through and I found it in their meeting with Richard Rogers, which was thoroughly, I was bemused, really. Didn't know about that. But while I was young, he used to, on the odd occasion, take me into work and encourage me to spend time with the architects because he thought they were more interesting. And I suppose
charming.
Yeah, I know. But I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I used to sit in a sea of drawing boards, you know, that old 70s look.
Yeah.
Cigarette smoke in the air. Characters that he worked with were so kind and encouraging. They let me help out with a bit of dye lining and using electric rubbers and, you know, playing with some of those, the implements that they use. I didn't know nothing about their function. And so actually, I think if I look truly into myself, I probably fell in love with the art and energy of an architect studio rather than architect itself.
Not to mention the attaché case and the cigarettes.
No, that's it. Exactly. Yeah. Definitely a hint of cigarette in the air. Sure. and then again he came in and he helped later on after I'd gained a place studying architecture at Thames Poly. And it was actually my dad that got me my first job as a part one student at Broadway Malian. So he was very instrumental in my sort of beginnings into the career, and I suppose I identified with him because he was my dad and he was Indian, and I automatically saw a way in. He never discouraged me from it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But while I was at, I think it's important as well to say that while I was at Broadway Malian, I had a absolutely fantastic mentor there. His name was Gary Whittle, and unfortunately he sadly passed away last year, which was devastating. But he was the first one to sort of encourage me to build my network and trusted me to run my own projects, even as a part one. He taught me that architecture was as much about personality and building relationships as it was about being a skilled designer. And I got to say that his voice is in my head even to this day.
Mm-hmm.
And he helped really to give me the confidence so that actually from a very early part of my career, I went into management level. And I've even had the opportunity to be in charge of some offices and studios myself as well. So with that sort of backdrop, from a personal perspective, I can't really say that I felt I've had massive barriers. I have to say really that if I've had any knockbacks in my career, I've deduced that maybe I just wasn't good enough for that, or maybe just a lack of confidence that held me back. But I wouldn't say that I was ever held back because of my race or colour.
Yeah. I think it was after the Insider dinner earlier this year, we were discussing the change over the last 15 years in terms of gender representation in the room. I know, 10, 15 years ago, I used to walk into a room and it really was just a sea of suits. And there were certainly fewer women there. And then you mentioned that when you looked around, you saw the lack of diversity, and that was particularly astounding today. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is?
I've thought about this, you know. Actually, I think before I answer that question, I think it's really important to say that when we talk about ethnic diversity, it's an incredibly emotive and subjective subject. So I'm conscious that I can't speak on behalf of everyone. What I accept, somebody else may not. And so as it's a very personal thing that relates to you and how you view yourself and the environment around you. Your early influences can have a real bearing on what you perceive to be the right thing to do and the wrong thing to do. So from a background point of view, I thought I'd just give a little bit of that to just sort of tell you what the context mm-hmm. is. So my parents are both from Bangalore, were from Bangalore in South India. And they had a very do as the Romans do approach. They were quite religious Hindus, but they weren't necessarily strict from a religious point of view. If they were strict, it was relating more to myself and my brother getting a really good education. So they didn't really instill heavy religion in us or instill any cultural differences. So I've had quite an open upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
So just that, I thought that was important to say really, because it's very difficult to give everybody's point of view on this.
Mm-hmm.
So back to the question, I think the first thing is that we're very stifled by the fear of speaking about this subject. Definitely don't speak about it openly for the fear of retribution.
In terms of everybody, or people who come from different backgrounds?
I think everybody, because, you know, at all our hearts, we don't want to upset anybody. Mm. Actually, some people's terminology is acceptable to them, but it isn't to others.
Yeah.
So you are, you know, it's highly likely that you might offend rather than not. And so people take a middle view, maybe, and look to say nothing, which is probably just as dangerous and just difficult to deal with. So that's why I think that, you know, above everything else, speaking about it freely and knowing that there's no retribution, as long as you are respectful, you take a respectful stance, and you view people as equal human beings, then you are allowed your own point of view. Mm-hmm. And people can't really object to that. But again, it's I think to be able to right the wrongs, you need to be able to have an open and frank discussion, really.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's driven a lot of what goes forward, because I think a lot of the intentions behind improving diversity are really good, but I think the approach is wrong.
Yeah.
So it's so difficult. I mean, I went away and had a look at this because even though I come from an ethnic background, doesn't mean I know it all. So I actually went away and had a look at the definition of ethnicity, which is a very difficult word to say, I have to say. And I had to practice that one a bit. And the definition is the fact of belonging to a particular nation or people that share a cultural tradition, mm-hmm. or a social group that has a common national or cultural tradition. So at the heart of it, it's got nothing to do with reference to race or colour. Yeah. It's actually much more about cultural diversity.
It's true, isn't it? And there's this fear of just lumping everybody into one bucket, as it were, you know, and that's everybody's different from person to person, completely different upbringings, you know, social class, gender, yeah. so many different things, isn't it?
Exactly. And even within ethnic groups, I can't speak for all Asian women, you know, because every single one of us will have been brought up in a different environment. And we'll have a different take on those influences that we've sort of taken on board as we've grown up. And I think that's one of the biggest things, actually, that homogenous group. We end up categorising ethnic groups rather than seeing them as individuals. And we don't see their merits and talents. And actually, as much as those are cultural differences, they're strengths as well. And I think that the industry tends to define groups through race rather than a broader cultural spectrum, which puts people in boxes based on colour, or the colour of their skin. And that's incredibly limiting to all, you know, both everybody, really.
Mm.
And I know some people might find structure in this, but I have to say, from a personal point of view, I am not a fan of BAME or BAM. I feel, to me, it feels like a catch-all, and the terminology actually feels quite derogatory and homogenous. When you look at those cultures under that heading or under that acronym, there's huge differences and strengths in those communities. They're not the same.
Mm.
And again, for me, I don't view myself as a minority. You know, I'm Chitra Marsh first and foremost. And I happen to just have an amazing appreciation of my, you know, accumulative Asian and British culture that's embodied in me.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big thing. And then on top of that, I think that employers sometimes can get preoccupied with diversity matrix and quotas as well, at the expense of sort of building a really truly inclusive workforce. And those are two very different goals, but they're not mutually exclusive. Sorry, I've got a little frog in my throat. I think also I would take something else, I suppose, lastly, role models are incredibly important as well. And they just aren't enough in the industry. Mm-hmm. Need people to look up to and aspire to become, you know. And if you can't see your place in the professional industry, I think you're less likely to pursue that career.
Definitely. I think the point you make about diversity metrics and quotas, you know, it comes up a lot in quite a disparaging way, and that's across diversity as a whole. But we do know, and employers know, that a diverse workforce brings sort of fresh ideas, balanced reasoning, you know, other people's experiences, and consequently that brings really good results. How can we break down those barriers to get a more varied workforce, I should say, in the property sector? I suppose it's also worth noting as well that our view of the property sector, we only see a portion of it as well, isn't it? You know, we sort of work in you know, development, architecture, planning. It's one part of the property sector, you know. We're looking at it through one little window. There's so much more to it as well. So I suppose we're guilty of that sometimes too.
Yeah, but that sort of means that we should, that it promotes that open discussion, because you begin to learn from each other about things.
But yeah, in terms of breaking down the barriers and encouraging sort of more diverse applicants and people involved in the sector, what practical things do you think we could do for that, to encourage that?
Well, I think if we reframe how we define ethnic diversity, and maybe we look more at the value of inclusivity. So a diverse workplace isn't necessarily an inclusive one. Diversity can actually engender hostility if it's done in the wrong way. It's quite hard for companies to transform diversity into inclusivity. I think if you start with inclusiveness, then you naturally diverse teams fall out of that, and it promotes an acceptance of people's differences. And just on that point of frank, open discussions, I think that both individuals and the industry are both responsible for opening up the conversations. And again, without fear of retribution, I think you then start to learn from each other. I certainly think that you don't proceed or end with a discussion that includes a comparison to the white middle-class male. Mm. This is about putting somebody else down to build somebody else up. It's about working together and learning, you know, and everybody in every group, you know, any gender, any ethnic group, we've all learned something that we can share and give to each other.
Mm. I've got to say, I do agree with that, Chitra. There's that phrase that goes round, which pale, male, stale. And I think it's a hideous, really disrespectful phrase. You know, we are looking at diversity and inclusivity, I think, is a really good point. And I think it's just, it doesn't help the argument at all, using that type of terminology.
No, and actually,
I agree with that.
Yeah, it actually further diminishes the value of inclusivity.
Mm.
What I'm saying is we need to tear somebody else down to bring you up. And actually, that's a terrible way of looking at it.
Definitely.
I think also, just going back to the quota boxes as well, I think if you try and remove that, the categorising and the quota delivering, certainly through the recruitment process, and you begin to see people for who they are, then you do naturally start to celebrate those strengths in cultural diversity. I think it's more important for employers to make their staff feel like they truly belong. Then they're free to contribute their talents. They can even achieve their own goals. That's a safe environment. And I think everybody then truly reaps the benefits of that.
Mm-hmm.
Staff will feel more engaged, and the company will benefit from attracting and retaining more talent. I think also what's core at all of this is that we talk about community as far as it's an inclusive culture. I think if you look at it as a community and you look at your strengths and weaknesses, you can then spot the talent deficit and recruit accordingly. So you look at the different cultures and the different talents that people bring, and those people also will bring innovation with them. And it means then the company is not just doing what they always do. It's embodying sort of those individual experiences and how people have their own personal situations. You can incorporate those, and actually it might be able to be something that you can apply to all employees. So with all of that, I think if you put all of that together, you're more likely to get an organisation that's got diversity in its workforce. And even more importantly, I think, it will ensure that all employees feel like they belong and that they can achieve their own goals.
Mm-hmm. One thing that can sometimes be quite difficult, it's the unconscious bias that you hear a lot about. And I remember hearing a case of a young lad, and he'd gone for a job with one of the hedge funds managers, and he was amazing on paper, and you know, he ended up having a fantastic career, but he just couldn't get a foot in the door. And the reason being, he did well in the interviews, but the sort of pre-interview small talk, you know, they were talking about, oh, have you been skiing this year? He just wasn't able to answer because his background, you know, his family didn't go skiing, you know, they couldn't afford to go skiing. This is more of a sort of a social, you know, sort of background, so they couldn't reach that point where they're quite relaxed and all chatting together and you sort of see a glimpse of the real person. And because he couldn't get that across, he just wasn't getting the roles. It would go to somebody that, you know, he or she would fit in well here, they've got the same mindset as us, we all get on, because they just didn't have that shared experience. And it's being aware, I suppose, when you are interviewing, of that unconscious bias and trying to separate that from the person that you're talking to. And it's very much, if you've got something in common with them, they're seen as a good fit for the company.
I think it's so difficult, that one, because unconscious bias is in everybody.
Mm.
It's a very difficult, I think you have to consciously unconscious bias. Yeah. Is that the right terminology? I don't know. But it's an incredibly difficult thing, and that it happens worldwide. Everybody in every country and every culture is unconsciously biased about something.
I was just going to say, you mentioned role models earlier on as well. How important do you think that is in encouraging younger people from different backgrounds coming forward?
Oh, so incredibly important. I mean, I had that to a certain extent with my dad. And I think you need to have more positive role models coming forward. You need to see how they have been a success so that you can then start to identify with them. You can relate to them on your own basis, and you can aspire to be what they are. I think if you're going for a career and you perceive that door is open to you, then that's more of a driving force, and that will help people find the way into their chosen career. I'd say that's much better and much easier. It'll help them to not see it as a barrier, or actually even worse still, no way in.
Mm. So I'm really passionate about telling young people about property and everything that's available to do in that. So the more diversity we see in our sector, then that will hopefully, you know, pass down the generation, pass down to kids, and that will help as well. So it's just, I suppose, for all young people from all backgrounds, is to get the message across to them is what you can do in this sector and the things you can achieve.
I mean, I see it actually, it's really, what's really positive is I do a lot of work with the university, the School of Architecture, and I see much more diversity at student level. And I think what's important now is making sure that that's sustained. Mm-hmm. So we don't lose them somewhere along the line because they feel that something has excluded them at somewhere, you know. So I think hopefully it's going the right way and in the right direction.
Are those the students that you see, are they overseas students studying in the UK?
Well, that's a very good point, actually. Yeah, there are a lot of overseas students, and I can't say that I'm an expert in homegrown talent. Interesting to see how much diversity there is in the homegrown talent, I think. but there's certainly a big influx of international students. Mm. But, you know, that's great because they may choose to stay and work here, and they will contribute to a workforce, you know, with their own backgrounds. And I think that's the whole point of making the world a bit smaller, is that you find, you learn from each other. I mean, as an architect, how often do we scroll through other people's projects, international projects, to learn?
Totally. For anyone who doesn't know, I don't think there are many people left, but I'm very, very passionate about intergenerational development and constantly looking at case studies and international examples of projects that are underway or research that's been done. And it's really, when you're looking at something quite niche, you have to go internationally and you have to look at how they've dealt with particular problems. But then, of course, each nation has a completely different social construct, family construct, so you've got to take all that into account. So it's just absolutely fascinating to see what people are doing all over the world. And yeah, in this day and age, it's easily attainable, isn't it? You can go and find that information very quickly, or go and talk to someone from that country very easily.
Yeah, and it drives innovation. I mean, we as a nation are known for our innovation, and it doesn't matter where you get it from, as long as you're innovating and you're taking it and making it better. And then in turn, that feeds back into the world, doesn't it?
Definitely. Well, talking of university, I know your daughter's studying at university. Have you persuaded her to join the property world?
Oh, Shannon. I think it's not a sore subject, actually, because I'm immensely proud of her. But I think when she was younger, she certainly did think about it. And because I used to take her in to work with me sometimes, and she would play around on the programs, and she absolutely loved it with the colouring pens and things like that. Mm-hmm. I think I actually had the opposite effect to my dad having had with me. She told me one day that she didn't want to be an architect anymore because it looked like too much hard work and we never seemed to have any money. Yes, and that was quite early on. So I think that's definitely not where she wants to go. But yeah, Now in the middle of doing a degree in biomedical science at Sheffield Hallam, and she's got the love for people as well too, but she's sort of seeing it more from a sense of helping them. She wants to work for the NHS and find cures for diseases. And I'm just so incredibly proud of her. She works so hard, and I really hope she reaps the rewards from her career, because I think she thoroughly deserves it. And she's made the right decision.
Yeah, she hit the nail on the head when she said long working hours, no money.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, no money.
When we initially discussed the podcast, you asked if we could play out on a particular song. And unfortunately, we can't play it for rights reasons, but can you tell a listener what your song was and why it means so much to you?
Oh, this is a bit like Desert Island Discs, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
It is. Oh, I think I'm slightly ashamed of this now, but it's a bit cheesy, but it's I Am What I Am by Gloria Gaynor, well, the Gloria Gaynor version. Uh-huh. I just think it's such an empowering song. I think if you could play that every morning to yourself, you go fighting fit into the day, I think. And I suppose it epitomises what I think I perceive personally. I've never really perceived myself as different to anybody else. And from an early age, I don't think I was ever truly conscious of my colour. I don't really remember. It doesn't stick out for me. The only thing that really stuck out when I was younger was that I hated getting darker in the sun, but actually now I absolutely love it. I can't get in. And also growing up through my years, I don't remember anybody treating me differently. I'm not going to lie and say that there weren't instances of racism or inappropriate language, but I usually dealt with it head on, and I still would. Mm-hmm. So, and I would say it's probably only occurred a handful of times. So I think I've sort of tried to work out, I've tried to work this one out, and I think it's possibly gone over my head. It's either that, or I've formed a protective layer somewhere on in my life, or unconsciously, I just don't care about it. It just And I've always said this, people will probably be bored of hearing this one, but I've always said that I see myself from the inside out. So I completely forget anything like that. I completely forget my colour. And the only time I ever think it's really evident is when I look in the mirror, which is a frightening thought in the morning. And I would probably say if I'm more conscious of anything, I'm more conscious of being female than I am brown. Mm. And I, because I'm not particularly religious, I am, however, incredibly proud of my Indian culture. And I think it brings a lot to me, and it meshes in so well with my British culture. And so my view has always been that I'm actually lucky to have the best of both.
Brilliant. And we're very lucky to have you as a role model in the industry. Thank you very much, Chitra. That was a really interesting discussion. I could talk about it for a lot longer. We should delve into so many different parts of it, because it is so complex, isn't it? This is not, you know, as you say, this is your experience. So everything is subjective. Yeah. But thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, well, thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And before we sign off, I do need to say, I've been told if you would like to subscribe to the Glenbrook podcast, please do. And we're always open to feedback. So if you've got any feedback, please let us know. Thanks, Chitra.
Thank you.